The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
When Vanessa first asked me to preach this Sunday while she and Laura are at the denomination's General Assembly, I gladly agreed. But when she then added that the theme for the month was freedom, I have to admit my heart sank a little. Because some words, it seems to me, can become so overused and abused in public discourse that at times a moratorium seems more fitting. Humanists, of course, say the same about that word G-O-D, and I get that. Although I would point out that it's just one word, one name among many, for that creative mystery that is within each and yet greater than all. But when it comes to freedom, what comes first to mind for me is the parable that the great Jewish sage Martin Buber often told, about how in the beginning of the modern world, around the time of the French and American revolutions, three ideals were said to walk together in the world: égalité, fraternité, liberté, the French said. But then in subsequent revolutions in the East and West, they became divided. Buber pointed out, equality went to the East, and in Russia and then China, it became the equal loss of individual freedom in a faceless collective. The equality of the gulag, or of China's masses all waving Chairman Mao's little red book. Meanwhile, liberty came to the West, to America, but also changed character. It became the freedom to steal, to exploit the land, and to exploit the labor of others, freedom from taxation or obligation, with equality more in democratic theory than in any actuality. While the third partner, the one that perhaps glued them together, fraternité, which we might more inclusively translate as kinship, that spiritual sense that we're all sisters and brothers, children of one mystery. Well, it went into eclipse, not modern, or was given mere lip service in places like this, in religious life. At times, of course, the spirit reemerged, and with some power and authenticity. I think of the American Civil Rights Movement, the Polish Solidarity Movement that helped end Soviet hegemony. Even in China that I visited in 1995, I found that after the brutal Cultural Revolution had failed to stamp out religion, the party, ironically, was beginning to call for a return of spiritual civilization. Yet here, idolatries of absolute freedom remain rather ubiquitous and persistent, worshipped in supposedly free markets that are actually free to be manipulated by oligarchs, in concepts of free speech that actually protect and nurture expressions of human hatred, among libertarians who rebel against educational or workplace efforts to be diverse, equitable, and inclusive, and I could go on, of course. One anti-Nazi German theologian on arriving on a ship in New York Harbor was asked by a reporter what he thought of the Statue of Liberty. "That lady," he said, "I think could use some of what we call demythologizing." Yet real, though finite, freedom of the human spirit remains undeniable, as Frankl learned when his own outward freedom was most confined. German freethinkers long had as one of their anthems the song, "Die Gedanken sind frei." My thoughts are as free as the wind or the ocean, and no one can see their form or their motion. No hunter can find them, no trap ever bind them. My lips may be still, but I think what I will. And our spiritual forebears in our faith tradition, the Transcendentalists, who often sought refuge from modernity's materialism and injustice in the world of nature, and in reflective exercises like journaling. So that Thoreau, for example, observed that many rush down to the post office for the latest news, who have not heard from themselves for a long time. I thought of him last night, because at the beginning of the Mexican War, he also said, "Blessed are the children, for they have not read the president's message." Our postmodern culture is arguably even more challenging. As Sam alluded to, the number of messages it sends to us constantly overwhelms us. Thanks to digital technology and the 24/7 news cycle, we are constantly bombarded by competing demands for our attention. TV journalist Chris Hayes has recently written about the erosion of all boundaries between public and private that this causes in a new book called The Siren's Call, How Attention Became the World's Most Endangered Resource. If attention is the substance of our lives, he writes, then the question of what we pay attention to is the question of what our lives will be, unquote. I probably don't need to tell you that clickbait, whether from advertisers, self-promoters, or politicians, leaves most of us, as T.S. Eliot once put it, distracted from distraction by distraction. Nor that the nation's narcissist in chief has proven himself highly adept at saying and doing so many attention-grabbing and outrageous things every day as to throw the whole body politic off balance. Yet how many of us truly take the time to discipline our attention? For that is the essence, my friends, of the spiritual life. About a year and a half ago, I decided I simply had to. I had long had an off and on practice of daily reflection, meditation, journaling, but I knew I needed to deepen it if I were to be a better citizen and a good caregiver to my dear wife of now 53 years together. So I sought out a respected spiritual director, one whom I knew was regarded as a colleague not only by Gwen, but also by our dear Minister Emerita, Margot Campbell Gross, who herself offers spiritual direction. And with John Kirkley's guidance, I began to sit each morning for at least 20 solid minutes of silent meditation and contemplative prayer. I also undertook two multi-day silent retreats, most recently, just 10 days ago, at the Hermitage of New Camaldoli down on the southern end of Big Sur. And I have begun to see that there are layers to the spirit within each of us. Personal reflection, like the long letters that Sam wrote in college, I think are where we all must begin, especially if we're going to set priorities. Real meditation, however, goes just a hair deeper, because it sets aside what spiritual directors call the narrative ego. Ultimately, the goal is contemplation, whether of a flower or simply what I have come to call the unmerited beauty of being itself. On my most recent retreat, in between periods of quiet contemplation, I was pondering a book called My Bright Abyss by poet Christian Wiman. He was diagnosed years ago with painful bone cancer. It was such a shock to his sense of, well, whether he would be available, really, that he hesitated then to fall in love, even. But finally, he found within himself the courage to do so and to marry. And then he and his wife hesitated to bring a child into the world, worrying that his offspring would have their childhood darkened by grieving their parent. But when he and his wife were blessed with twin daughters, he writes movingly about just watching them as toddlers, touching each other, playing with each other, kissing each other, and dares to write, "The default setting of the human spirit," I concluded, "is joy." We need to work, my friends, to uncover that again. Put another way, despite the ubiquitous reality of suffering in this world, much of it unmerited, there is also a brightness, even in the depths of the abyss. The great contemplatives and mystics have always known and taught and cultivated this. Now, I know some of what passes for spirituality today, especially out here on the left coast, tries to simply skate on the surface. It would encourage nothing but positive thinking, self-affirmation. As one of my theological mentors put it, there's nothing quite so saleable in this world as egoism wrapped in idealism. There are plenty of places to buy it. I find it better to put the ego aside and make room for what Thich Nhat Hanh calls the great compassion. Some also worry that spirituality and contemplative prayer can evade the urgencies of the activism of good citizens. But I say nothing could be further from the truth. Rather, real spiritual practice is a reclaiming of the inner freedom that is necessary to persist and set priorities in pursuit of the common good. As that great contemplative yet active activist for peace and justice, Thomas Merton, wrote, "True spiritual freedom is the inability to choose evil or to ignore it." Sound spirituality may include acceptance of those things that can't be changed, to be sure, which encompasses all that is past, including the adverse outcome of elections, or our own past failings. But it also seeks the courage to change what can be changed, like any lingering sense in us of helplessness. For there is a power and a freedom within. The wisdom to know the difference is found in a spiritual practice that helps us discern where and how we can best put that finite freedom to use for the common good. For the fruits of the Spirit, as Scripture puts it, are indeed love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Now, love may also be a word that's overused, but compassion and empathy, they're synonyms, are not, as another public narcissist has recently claimed, likely to lead to the downfall of civilization. In fact, there are two central mistakes that we tend to make about love, I've come to believe. The late Dr. Gerald May, a psychiatrist and lay theologian who co-founded the Shalem Institute for Spiritual Formation, that's now one of the leading training networks for spiritual directors, said that the theological mistake is to think that God's love is ever anything other than infinite, universal, and even unconditional. Despite religionists who always want to narrow it and claim that it is available only to some, like them, or to the righteous. No. No. As Jesus himself taught, God is so loving as to make the sun to shine and the rain to fall on the just and the unjust alike. That's universalism, my friends. The other mistake is to think that our human loving can ever be anything other than finite, personal, and, yeah, more or less conditional, as we discover growing up. Said May, different personality styles then tend to develop in us. One reaction, particularly to highly manipulative parenting, is narcissistic self-protection. You aren't going to love me absolutely? Well, then I'll love myself all the more. And believe that everyone should. And if some don't, well, then the hell with them. Needless to say, there's a fair amount of this about these days. And that those who display such traits can be popular simply shows that not giving a damn is admired by way too many people, sadly. A second personality type tries to fill the perceived lack of love with one's own gushiness and sentimentality, idealism and hypersensitivity. The ego affirmations of our therapeutic culture, it seems to me, as well as a lot of New Age spirituality, both manifest and try to minister to those who react to human love's finitude in that way. And then there's a third pattern, which I rather readily see in myself and in many others who are strivers and achievers. Finding and feeling that love is finite, we think we have to react by working harder to do and be as good as we can in order to earn love, forgetting to trust the abundant love that has already blessed us on our way, that has brought us thus far, and that continues every moment, as Dante puts it in the final line of his Paradiso, to move the sun and the other stars. To put love at the center, as we Unitarian Universalists in our new statement of core values dare to claim we do, requires some careful distinctions on these points. In a piece that she wrote for a collection of essays with the title Love at the Center, my dear friend Rebecca Parker, with whom I once co-authored a book about progressive theology, writes that in her own spiritual practice, when she found that she was most fearful or despondent or distracted, she had to return over and over again to a simple mantra that she then offers to us all. There is a love holding me. There is a love holding all that I love. There is a love holding all. I rest in that love. I rest in that love. To begin or deepen a spiritual practice need not be complicated, my friends. It's best if it's rather simple. There's a good resource and a little half-hour video on our UUSF YouTube channel called Living by Heart. I've shared it with some of you. And in it, Reverend Laurel Hallman interviews the late Harry Schofield, who graced this pulpit and led this congregation for nearly 20 years, about his practice of meditation. You'll find that it offers multiple starting places. Simply put, this is the paradox I wish you will take away today, that is both wise and worth embracing. Spiritual discipline brings real inner freedom. Take the time. Pay attention. Learn how to direct your attention. And you may both seek and find it, that wisdom. Or so I at least hope and pray. And not just for ourselves, but for the needs of our whole distracted and disconnected world. Why? Because we need to reclaim the unmerited beauty of being itself, its joy, and its call to justice, which, after all, is what love looks like when it goes out in public, right? So let us take all those things as we go forth into a world that needs us and show it, not in words alone, but in our inner witness, each day and in every interaction. So may it be. Amen.
Have you ever gotten a letter or an email from someone that just seemed to go on and on and on? Well, in college, it was me sending those letters. Instead of changing, I decided to own it, so I called them my verbose letters. In general, once a quarter, I would write a many pages long letter to everybody that I knew with updates on my life. The different classes I was taking, the clubs that I was in, philosophical musings, reflections on talks and events I went to, the works. I'm more of a humanist, so I don't have a lot of explicitly spiritual practices like prayer or meditation, but I think these verbose letters scratched an itch that might have been coming from that same place. I tried hard to be introspective, to really reflect on how my life had been going. Many of the reflections that I've given up here were originally based on something that I had written about years ago in a verbose letter. Reflections on death, reflections on living in an unjust world, on what justice even is, on understanding my limits. Writing these letters really was an exercise in better understanding myself. And it wasn't just about the letter itself either. It was something that crept into every part of my life. I always knew that I would be writing a new letter in a few months, so I would sometimes think, is this something that would make it into a verbose letter? If I was considering staying in, watching TV, probably not. If I was thinking about volunteering or going to an interesting talk, probably yes. Knowing that I was going to be introspective, knowing that I was going to reflect on my time, and in a public way, helped me spend my time better, helped me live my life more in line with my values, let me avoid being trapped by what was easiest or most convenient. I would be remiss if I didn't emphasize the public point. I still journal, but my reflections aren't usually public, with certain obvious exceptions. Part of the reason why sharing my reflections mattered is because we, or at least I, am more accountable to something when it's public. I'm much better at being accountable to someone else than I am to myself. But it also helped me be closer with other people. Introspection and reflection are fundamentally an act of vulnerability, which is the essence of what can bring people together, closer to one another. And every time I wrote one, it was an invitation to folks to reconnect with me, with plenty of conversation starters built in. I think that's one thing that makes church communities like this one so special. Things like small group ministry encourage us to reflect and share with each other, but even outside of that, every service is an invitation to reflect on ourselves and an invitation to share those reflections with everyone else who just went through the same experience. I feel like we're deluged by generic AI-generated writing, political crises, recycled TikTok videos about the flavor of the month, just so much noise everywhere you look. It gets in your head, it can be hard to think through it, hard to just appreciate the simple beauty around us. And a lot of people are trying to cut through the noise just by shouting louder. But I think what really cuts through is authenticity. Authentic reflection, authentic values, authentic connection with other people. Even if that authenticity comes in the form of a letter that's way too long for anybody to actually read.